Welcome to Amici, the podcast of the New York State Unified Court System. I'm John Carr. Today's program is what might be called a bookend episode. Regular listeners may recall that Judge Richard B. Lowe III was on Amici a couple of years ago when he was installed as chairman of the Franklin H. Williams Judicial Commission. Now his term is at an end as he retires from his day job as presiding justice of the appellate term First Department. He has had what anyone would consider an illustrious career. Graduate of St. John's University Law School, Assistant District Attorney in Manhattan, Inspector General in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Chief Counsel to the House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Oversight, Chief Counsel to the House Select Committee on Narcotics Abuse and Control, New York City Criminal Court Judge, Supreme Court Justice. Judge Lowe has a unique perspective on government for the simple reason that he's seen it from all three branches. Judge Lowe, thanks for coming back on the program. You're one of our few repeat visitors. Before we get into the work of the commission and your work as presiding justice, let's go somewhere we didn't go before and tell me about your background. Where were you born? What did your parents do? What was your childhood like?
Okay. Well, I was born and raised in the Bronx. I'm one of six children. I have a twin brother. My father was a decorated police officer. He got the Medal of Honor from Mayor Wagner at the time. My mother worked in the Women's House of Detention, but as in the financial department. So I went to school in the Midwest. I went to the University of Wisconsin, then came back to New York and went to law school at St. John's University.
Why did you decide to go to law school rather than into follow your father into law enforcement?
My brother did. Well, I'll tell you, there's a funny story how I became a lawyer. My brother and I and my father were working in our front yard one day, and I must have been about 12 or 13, something like that. And I was running my mouth. And my father said to me, you know, you talk so much, you should be a lawyer. And believe it or not, that stayed with me. And I never thought of doing anything other than being a lawyer. And that's what happened.
What did you take in college as an undergraduate?
I majored in history and a political science minor.
And at that point, you still knew you wanted to be a lawyer. You already knew that.
From that day on, I never thought of being anything else.
Did you have an idea of what sort of a lawyer you'd be, what kind of law you would practice?
Well, not really until when I was in my second year of law school, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office had flyers posted throughout the school, and they seeking summer interns, and I needed a summer job, so I went down there, and I got hooked, I started my career on the criminal side. I was a prosecutor for 13 years, and when I became a judge, I sat on the criminal side for about 15 years before I moved to the civil side. But I've had, I have been in all three branches of government. So I have seen the law from all three sides. And I can, quite frankly, understand the distinctions depending on what branch of government you're in. There's a difference between enacting legislation to satisfy certain constituents and applying the legislation, and then as a judge determining either the legality or the justice of the particular legislation. So it's been an interesting career for me in that regard. It has served me well as a judge, meaning being in the executive branch and the legislative branch.
I marvel at the wisdom of our founders in creating those three branches, and how well they keep each other in check.
In it, you really can see it and understand it.
Now, how did you position yourself to become a judge?
Well, you know, it's funny because a couple of things in my life have occurred, and it simply validates the adage that at least from my perspective, 90%, maybe 95% of life is timing. When I was in Washington, I was on the legislative side. I was Inspector General under Jimmy Carter, and when Reagan defeated him, Reagan fired all of the Inspector Generals, and so then I went to work on the Hill, and I was Chief Counsel for the House Select Committee on Narcotics and the House Select Committee on Oversight. And so after about 8 years in D.C., it turned out that my mother died, and my father, who had six children, all of whom were gone, was home alone, and as it is with most, particularly men who've been married a long time and their spouse passes, my father did not do very well. Mm. So I got a letter from Mayor Koch, who at the time apparently had been coming under criticism for not appointing women and minorities to the bench. And so he actually formed a committee and told people to find him qualified minorities and women. And lo and behold, I got a letter down in Washington from Koch asking if I would consider going on the bench. And so the timing was such that I saw that as a vehicle to bring me back to New York. My father and I were going to redo the house that I grew up in. Unfortunately, the night of my final interview with the Association of the Bar's Committee on the Judiciary, I got notified that my father had passed away.
So he never got to see you as a judge?
He never got to see me as a judge, but he wanted me to do it. His refrain to me was, "You become your own judge. What you're doing down there is carrying somebody else's water." And that's what he thought of politics. So, and I'm glad I did. On reflection, I think I've had a pretty decent career.
I don't think there's any question about that. Let's shift gears and talk about the commission, if we could. For those who are unfamiliar with it, the Franklin H. Williams Commission is comprised of judges, attorneys, court personnel, and others appointed by the chief judge and charged with developing strategies to promote racial and ethnic fairness in the courts. It was created in, 1988 by then Chief Judge Sol Wachler and later named after its first leader, Ambassador Franklin Hall Williams. Judge Lowe, you've been a member of the commission, I think, since 1993 when you were appointed by probably Judge Judith Kaye. And, of course, you've been chair since 2015. I know there's been a lot done on your watch, including an all-day conference a couple of months ago entitled Mass Incarceration, Mercy Matters. Let's start, if we could, with what is the issue, and why is that an issue of the commission, the mass incarceration, Mercy Matters?
Well, if you think about it, the whole concept of mass incarceration, just the phrase itself speaks volumes. And unfortunately, mass incarceration affects the minority community far more than certainly the white community. The it does not solve the issue, particularly when we now in this country have moved away from rehabilitation to simply incarceration. And so when people do get out, they have they don't have any training. They don't have any connection to the community. And so the likelihood of recidivism is exponentially higher.
I know one of our former governors, I mean, Governor Pataki, used to say that the root cause of crime was criminals, which I imagine you would think is rather simplistic. But have we changed since then? Have we obviously things took a different direction under Governor Pataki. Have things taken a turned the other direction at all under Governors Spitzer, Patterson, and Cuomo?
Well, what I see is a change in the attitudes, quite frankly, across the country and politically. You have both political parties strongly speaking of criminal justice reform and the expense of housing so many people for so long periods of time. It doesn't benefit the society. It doesn't benefit the local cities and states. So I do see a change, but right now, so far, it's only an attitude. I don't see the implementation of this big push for criminal justice reform. There's a lot of talk about it, but I'm still waiting for it really to happen. And
yeah,
that reform has to do with the whole concept of incarceration. I mean, look, I think we are the second country in the world that, now I think one country has a higher incarceration rate than we do.
Yeah, perhaps China.
Yeah. So hopefully when these two parties can get together and put their heads together, they can come up with some significant changes in criminal justice.
Yeah, I'm afraid that'll be a long-term project.
Well, yeah.
Now, what other achievements are you most proud of during your 2 years as chair, or for that matter, your quarter century on the commission?
Well, first of all, I think the commission itself, we like to think of ourselves as having the thumb on the scale, so to speak. We try, even though we've had great cooperation from the past chief judges, and I certainly expect the same of the current chief judge, but we have we've sort of tried to be the pulse of our justice system here in New York, and to sort of keep an eye on both the hiring, not just of judges, but particularly court personnel on all levels. I'm having some difficulty describing this because we try to identify issues. We bring them to the attention of those in authority. We have these large conferences, such as mass incarceration, and we try to educate and to keep the like I said, keep our thumb on the scale so that people are aware of what is going on and aware of the shortcomings, and we can try to apply some pressure to have changes made.
I understand. Now, there's some who say we're in, quote, post-racial America, and that there's no longer a need for commissions such as this one. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think that's wishful thinking. This whole concept of post-racial, look, you know, the clearest example of that is when Obama was elected president twice. People, and unfortunately, particularly white people in general, and on a positive note, you know, felt that we were now post-racial. Mm-hmm. And when someone says that, the first thing I ask them is, you tell me the way that president was treated, and tell me if we are post-racial. No one was, I don't recall a president having to deal with what President Obama did. And now that we have, unfortunately, now that we have the current president, I think people now feel it's almost, it's okay to express their, you know, their isms. It's look, there was an article in either yesterday or today's paper describing how when crowds yell Trump, 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 those are code words for, you know, for speaking negatively about minorities. And so, if anything, I think we are regressing.
That's sad to hear.
Well, it's sad but true, as the expression goes.
Yeah. Now, let me bring up another commission project that was initiated on your watch, but won't be completed for several months yet. A documentary on the life of Franklin Williams.
Yes.
As you well know, your executive director, Joyce Hartsfield, and I have been working together on that project for a number of months, and maybe you could explain to our listeners just who Franklin Williams was and the importance to the country, the state, and the commission of doing this documentary.
Well, I think we are who we are, meaning this commission, because of that man. Chief Judge Wachler had received complaints from minorities in the court system about treatments, about lack of promotions, etc. And so he commissioned Franklin Williams. He commissioned him to chair an investigative commission to examine all aspects in the court system with regard to minorities, the treatment, the representation, etc. I mean, you know, you had court officers that would go down to their dressing rooms and find all sorts of posters on locker rooms that were obviously unflattering. And so Williams agreed to do this, but he had three conditions. He was going to hire his own staff. He would, he required complete and total access to all aspects of the court system. And he would finance it himself. And he did this. And he and Wachler became not just respected individuals, but they became friends. And as a result, Wachler named this commission to be permanent so that there could be a permanent pulse within the court system, as I said, examining, you know, the treatment of minorities, the representation, etc.
Judge Walker told us that when he first talked to Franklin Williams about this, Ambassador Williams warned him that he was going to open some pretty serious wounds. And Walker said he did not realize at that time how deep the wounds were or how serious the problem was.
That is true. I think that was one of the basis for Walker deciding that this commission needed to, not just remain, but be a part of the court system.
That kind of goes back to what we discussed a moment ago about whether we are in or will reach post-racial America. I think there's probably a need to be vigilant always.
Yeah.
I don't know that we get to a point where it's no longer, where we can stop paying attention.
As long as there are differences, as long as there are different, ethnicities, you're going to have tensions. The question is to try to ensure that those tensions are, first of all, are dealt with, and so that we can teach each group how to respect each other. We can have differences, but we can, we can be respectful. And so I really think that that was, you hit it on the head. I think that was the driving force behind Judge Walker's decision, because it did open some wounds, let me tell you.
I know it did. Now, when we interviewed you for the documentary, you spoke of Ambassador Williams' passion for equality and fairness, and you speculated on the genesis of that passion. Can you share those thoughts with our listeners?
Yes. I think part of it, Williams was in the military. In the 40s, and it was segregated, and yet I forget what rank he held when he came out, but in any event, here he is fighting for our country, and then he gets out and he has to deal with the kind of society that lynches black people, he goes to law school at Fordham Law School, and I think he was probably one of two or three minorities in the law school.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he graduated law school, he became a member of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and he worked with Thurgood Marshall. He and Marshall were, they totally respected one another, but there was tension between them. Marshall was more deliberate than Franklin Williams, and I don't want to mischaracterize this, but Franklin, whenever he saw an injustice, he just rode to try to rectify it. Marshall was more measured. Marshall, as head of the Legal Defense Fund, he would not take a case to the Supreme Court unless, in beyond a reasonable doubt, he felt he would win that case. Whereas Franklin, if there was an injustice, he wanted to take that case to the Supreme Court. The problem is, at least from Marshall's perspective, if you lose, then you've got some bad precedent there that you're going to have to deal with down the road. Whereas with Marshall, if you win, each case case you take, you win, and that sets precedent on our side. So there was tension between them, but you know, the irony is that Marshall was one of the people who recommended Williams to Judge Wachler.
Yeah, one of two. The other one was Vernon Jordan.
Yes.
But you know, what you mentioned about the relationship between Thurgood Marshall and Franklin Williams is what we have uncovered in our research, and I think you're absolutely right that Thurgood was, you know, I think they both wanted to get to exactly the same point.
Oh yeah.
And there was, but the you know, Thurgood was a little older, maybe a little wiser, maybe a little more politically astute, and you know, he was concerned about what we've learned. A couple of things. One, exactly as you said, if you take a case to the Supreme Court and you lose, you've set the case, your cause back maybe 50 years, maybe longer. And he was also concerned about fundraising. You know, Franklin, if there was someone's constitutional rights were violated, Franklin wanted to fight for them, even if they were guilty. Thurgood was a little more concerned about whether he could raise money from black families to fund the defense of someone who had committed a heinous murder or rape or whatever. So there's an interesting dynamic there that you mentioned.
And white families.
Absolutely, you know, absolutely.
Those who were willing to give, yes.
Sure. Now, Thurgood and Franklin worked on some historic cases together. Can you mention a couple of those?
Well, one of them, and to me, one of the most famous, and which is widely known now, was a case that was from Florida.
The Groveland case is what I think you're going to refer to.
Yes, and there's a book that just came out, well, I don't know how, maybe 2-3 years ago, that's all, came out, Devil in the Grove.
Yeah, it won a Pulitzer Prize, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny, when I tried to discuss Franklin Williams with people, I urged them to read Devil in the Grove. The irony is that that's a case that Thurgood Marshall gets a lot of credit for, because he took it ultimately to the Supreme Court and prevailed. But Franklin was actually a lawyer who went down to Florida to defend three young black men who were accused of raping a white girl. One of them was ultimately murdered. Franklin
by the sheriff.
By the sheriff, yes. And Franklin Williams was almost killed himself. And the second case.
Let me back up 1 second. When you say Franklin Williams is almost killed himself, I think you're referring to the incident where, after the trial, he was literally chased out of town by a lynch mob.
That's correct.
Which almost caught him.
They did. They almost caught him. And so what I'm trying to say is that Franklin was down in Florida for the duration of those trials. There was more than one trial. There were two trials. Thurgood Marshall, he gets the case after it's over, so that you know, he gets it to appeal it, and he wasn't in the he wasn't in the thicket.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I'm not trying to make one more important than the other. They just had different
roles, actually. You know?
Roles.
Sure. Now, our consultant on the documentary, Dr. Enid Gort, who has researched Franklin extensively and wrote a doctoral dissertation on him, he's referred to Franklin as a quote bridge figure, and someone who could effectively navigate the black and white communities. What she would say is that Franklin was articulate and eloquent, rational as opposed to emotional, and also rather fair-skinned, and perhaps not as threatening as others might have been. Do you buy that he was an effective civil rights advocate because he was maybe easier for some white people to stomach?
You know, look, this is, if you asked Franklin Williams that, I think he would, you know, I just think that he would not be very appreciative of that. But I will tell you, that is simply a fact. And I've seen it in my life. I often describe myself to people as light, bright, and almost white. And I have seen both friends of mine, co-students, co-workers who are dark-skinned and didn't have doors open to them the way I had doors open for me. It's simply a fact that the lighter you are as a black person, the less threatening you are in general to general white society. And so, you know, you get your foot in the door and you have opportunities to impress people. And so I suppose, let me put it this way. If that's her description, I certainly would not refute it because I've experienced it myself.
Yeah, I think what she would say is that he was able to be successful in part because some prominent white people didn't look at him as all that different from themselves.
Yes.
And if he had very, very Africanish features, he may have been viewed as more different than he really was. I think it's just a
different or threatening. You know, there's a big thing that we deal with in the commission is implicit bias. And the reason that's so dangerous is because you don't know you have it. That's by nature. The very definition of implicit bias is it's there, but you're not aware of it. And so, as I said, the more many white people are, they're simply threatened by you know, dark black people. I certainly would not refute her description.
Let's put the focus back on you, if we could. My guess is the vast majority of New Yorkers, and probably the vast majority of lawyers outside of New York City, don't know what the appellate term is. Can you just give us a quick primer on what your court is and what it does?
Well, New York State has three appellate levels. And the lowest level is the appellate term, mid-level is the appellate division, and then the highest court is the New York State Court of Appeals. The appellate term hears appeals from three courts: the lower criminal court, misdemeanors, the lower civil court, and that's the case that has a value of, I think they've raised it to $50,000 now, and the housing court. Now, the housing court is the closest thing to a people's court that I can describe. You know, I see a level of my work with the Franklin Commission as I preside in cases in housing court. Because housing court, unfortunately, you deal with a large percentage of unrepresented people. Mm-hmm. Although we're moving to change that. When I say we, I'm talking lawyers, just like legal aid for criminal cases, they're trying to implement representation for people in housing court that are unrepresented.
Sure. Access to justice, of course, was the a major priority for Chief Judge Lippman and continues to be a priority for Chief Judge DeFiore, I believe.
Yes. And see, you know, with housing court, you're dealing with, unfortunately, a significant number of poor people, black and white, but a larger percentage of minorities, because these are people who are, a lot of people are living in subsidized housing, and there are often attempts by landlords to get them out so that they could have their apartments go market in terms of the amount of rent they can charge. And so it's and the interesting thing is that we have many unrepresented people who appear in the appellate term to argue their own appeals. And it's significantly important for the court to give them the total opportunity, even though they're not experienced, even though they don't, you know, oftentimes know the law. We don't give the court away. We just give them the opportunity to be heard. I don't think that there's anything more important for a judge to do than to make people feel, when they leave the courtroom, that they were treated fairly and that they had an opportunity to express themselves.
Win or lose?
Win or lose, yes.
Okay. Now, what do you think your prime contributions were as the presiding justice?
Well, I am sort of known as a no-nonsense judge. Unfortunately, when I took over as PJ, we had a significant backlog in the cases that had been decided by us by the appellate term, but the decisions had not been publicized. And so one of the first things that I did was to put into place mechanisms for us to get our decisions out as soon as we could.
Morning.
And I'm proud to say that when I leave and turn over my chair, there is not going to be a single case that has not been published.
Wow.
Yes, yes. I'd say that that's one of my most the things that I'm proudest of, because it was it was a problem. And as a matter of fact, the Law Journal did a stinging article on the backlog in the appellate term. That no longer is the case. And that, now that's administratively, and I have to say that, you know, when you're PJ, when you're presiding, when you're the presiding judge, you run the court, and it's your responsibility to ensure that the court is run administratively as well as it is run fairly.
Mm-hmm. So what's next on the agenda for Richard Bryant Lowe III?
Everybody asks me that question. I will tell you this. My wife is going to retire next year. And the first two things that we are going to do is travel and play golf. My wife happens to be a very good golfer, but I enjoy it too. But we want to do some travel. And we've made it a commitment that we are going to try to take two trips a year, one across the pond and the other within the United States. There's so many places in this country that are deserving of visiting, and so many places that we have yet to see. I've never seen Alaska. Believe it or not, I have not seen the Grand Canyon. And so we're taking a big trip in May to Australia, and then when we come home, we're going to the Grand Canyon.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, and then if, you know, my wife is also very capable, and if both of us, either of us, get a little, you know, antsy or feel the need to get back into the game, I don't have any doubt that I can get back in. I could be a mediator, an arbitrator. I could teach. I could, you know, there's a lot of things I can do. Right now, I'm just going to enjoy myself.
Thanks for listening to Amici. You'll find all of our podcasts, which now number more than 50, on the New York State Court System website at www.nycourts.gov. And you'll also find many of them in the iTunes podcast library. If you have a suggestion for a topic that ought to be covered on Amici or someone who ought to be interviewed, please give me a call. I'm John Carr, and I'm at 518-453-8669, or send me a note at jcaher@nycourts.gov. In the meantime, stay tuned.